Global Story is your new daily deep dive into one big news story. And it's coming soon, Monday to Friday, from the BBC World Service. Search for The Global Story wherever you get your BBC podcasts to find out more.
Ironically, his decision to concede the election may be one of his biggest legacies as president because, as you know, in Africa, it's very rare that heads of state or presidents embrace the result of election, but he was able to do that without any qualms.
Africa's footballing president has been given the red card by voters. But how did George Weah conduct himself in office? Hello, it's Wednesday, the 22nd of November. I'm Richard Kagoy with Focus on Africa. Also in the program, campaigners say more and more girls in Africa are dropping out of school early, with many ending up married as children. We look at which parts of the continent are worst affected and why it's happening.
Countries where there's conflict, for example, Ethiopia, Niger, there's also countries where there are cyclones like Mozambique and Malawi, other highly indebted countries, Ghana, Zambia included.
First, we go to Liberia. Liberians are waiting to swear in their new president. Joseph Boakai, a former vice president under Africa's first elected woman president, Ellen Johnson Sirleaf, beat Ms. Sirleaf's successor, George Weah, in nail-biting runoff. For a country that had suffered back-to-back civil wars in the late 20th century and early 21st century, Liberia seems to be doing democracy quite well. George Weah became president in 2017. A star footballer, used to play for Paris Saint-Germain, AC Milan, Chelsea and Manchester City. One of the greatest footballers of all time, Pele rated George Weah among the world's greatest living players. So, the man came with kudos on the football field. But we're here to discuss his legacy as president of Liberia, which is what he became in 2017 after beating his opponent Joseph Boakai by a huge margin. When the two men went toe-to-toe this time around, George Weah's popularity had dwindled. Joseph Boakai won by a whisker. So, where did Mr. Weah's popularity disappear to? Rodney Sear has written a book about George Weah. He's also the founding editor of Front Page Africa and just the man to help us assess Mr. Weah's legacy.
Well, George Weah got off to a rocky start. First of all, I think one of the biggest mistakes he made is that he came to power on the groundbreaking movement of a grassroots movement, believing that he was popular, so he didn't need the media. So he turned it back on the media and didn't really embrace them. His press conferences was mostly antagonistic toward the media. I think that hurt him a bit. And also, there are lots of early mistakes he made in terms of bringing people to government who were not experienced. Although he brought a lot of grassroots players into the game, into the cabinet positions, but that didn't really sit well because they just didn't know how to perform. And that kind of paved the way and set the pace for what became George Weah's legacy as president.
I must have got off to a shaky start. Was that simply because of the lack of experience or appropriate advice, possibly from people who had a bit of insights into how governments run and how politics is managed?
I mean, to his credit, he tried to give a lot of those who supported him, a lot of the grassroots people, positions in government, which they would never have gotten in any other situation. But in a sense, that was also one of his Achilles. They were just not experienced. And I think he gave them too much leverage. And as a result, it became a handicap for his government. Most agencies and ministries were simply not up to the task, and it became a problem for a lot of people who were hoping that this grassroots movement led by George Weah would have done something greater.
And, you know, just in the early years of his administration, he just ran into a huge challenge, and that was the Ebola epidemic. I remember actually the World Health Organization declaring it. This was quite a massive challenge, and it was not just a problem confined to Liberia because it spread, you know, across in Sierra Leone and Guinea, which forced actually the three countries to impose a lockdown. How did he handle that?
Well, as you know, the Ebola was one of the issues with Ellen Johnson Sirleaf administration. Weah's biggest challenge in the health sector was during the coronavirus epidemic. And I think that, in a sense, was something that gave the government a blank eye because a lot of people thought it wasn't handled properly in terms of how the health sector was performing. But there were a lot of cases in Liberia. People died because people felt the government didn't really take the issue seriously in the beginning. And that, in a sense, made it very difficult for the government to control the situation.
One of the things that a lot of people observed was just the general conduct of the government or just the management of government affairs. And sometimes then you would have a situation where a government may not be popular, but of course, the office holder in the case of the presidency, in this case, would have been George Weah, would have been popular. I don't know how he managed or navigated through these difficulties to sustain his popularity. Did he manage to do that even in the face of these challenges?
If you look at the results of the election, you can say that the country is deeply divided. But all along, George Weah's support has always been around the 36, 40 to 45%. The question has been whether that was enough to take him over the top. It did in 2017 elections, but this time around, because of the way his government ran the show, a lot of people didn't think that it would suffice. And so the thing is, a lot of supporters are angry that he conceded. In fact, they're saying that he should have fought, you know, as an incumbent. He didn't use his power the right way to maintain power. And he just conceded when many thought that he would fight. You know, and that was some of the things that helped me. Ironically, his decision to concede the election may be one of his biggest legacy as president, because as you know, in Africa, it's very rare that African heads of state or presidents embrace the result of election. But he was able to do that without any qualms.
And it's not just about conceding defeat, but even just how he did it. Could you tell me just about the significance of that and what it did to the psyche of ordinary Liberians?
Well, honestly, a lot of people thought that Weah would not give up power. They thought that he was going to be fighting, you know, he was going to hold on to power and be reluctant to give up. But they were very shocked that with 99.58% of the vote counted, he was still behind by 28,000 votes. He decided that with less than 0.4% left, there were numbers just wasn't there for him to win. So he decided that it was time to call it quits, and he just hung in the towel. And I think it's something that the party will have to go back to the drawing board and see what went wrong, what happened, and how they can bounce back in 2029.
Rodney, in terms of democracy, you know, this has really been described as a win for Liberian democracy. Is that how people largely are viewing this within Liberia and, of course, within the region?
Yeah, I mean, reaction from Sierra Leone and president and other countries around the region, including the U.S. President Joe Biden. We've had one successful transfer of power from President Ellen Johnson Sirleaf to George Weah. Now we're having George Weah about to transfer power to Joe Boakai. So that since the end of the Civil War, Liberia's democracy has turned a new page. And a lot of people are saying that this democracy is taking roots. It's been slow, but I think these two successive transfer of power seem to give Liberia a new lease on life in terms of democracy.
In terms of his legacy, how would you describe it? Would you describe it as a, you know, sweet memories or just a bitter disappointment among Liberians?
I think mostly a bitter disappointment. If you look back on George Weah's career, where he came from the grassroots, as a footballer from the slums of Gibraltar, West Point, Sony Way, all those community slums where he grew up from, I think people expected a lot more. Like I addressed in my book, The Story of Africa's Footballer President, I think those were things that people expected, that someone from that era, from that time, from those areas, from those slums would be able to resurrect and bring new hope to those people. And he did bring hope to them in the sense that he gave them jobs, but in the sense of performance, in the sense of changing their dynamics, changing their lifestyle, changing the way they live, I think very little can be said about how their lives have changed over the last 6 years. And I think if anything has happened to his legacy, it will be the fact that, I mean, he did do some development areas around the city, Monrovia, in terms of building estates for poor families. But most of the communities in rural, you know, Liberia are still struggling for a better life. And many parents can afford to send their kids to school. Those things are the bread and butter issues, I think, is where he missed the mark.
And maybe, Rodney, because you've been following George Weah, you published, and of course, you've been following the politics in Liberia. Do you think this defeat is just a temporary setback for George Weah, and he will be sort of like making a comeback at some point?
It all depends on George Weah. I think if he's really sincere about making a comeback, I think he will have to do a lot of things differently. I think he's seen that there are certain things voters will not tolerate. I think he's seen that he made a lot of mistakes. I think he's seen that he's done some things that he shouldn't have done. Maybe if he would do it again, he would stop the booga dance, he would stop the singing music, he would stop those, you know, traveling abroad for 1 month while the World Cup is on to see his son play. I think those things he took for granted. I think he felt he was so popular that no matter what he did, people would vote for him.
Rodney Sear, editor and author of the book, The Story of Africa's Footballer President. Let's head to the Republic of Congo next, where the government has today declared a day of national mourning in memory of those killed in a stampede in the capital, Brazzaville. At least 37 people were killed and more than 100 injured during an army recruitment drive Monday night, the government said in a statement. Residents have been quoted as saying that people tried to force their way through the stadium gates, causing the stampede. Last week, the army announced plans to recruit about 1,500 people between the ages of 18 and 25. I called up our local reporter, Emery Makumeno, who began by telling me when the recruitment process began.
The exercise started on November the 14th, about a week ago, but particularly last Monday, people were told to come back later on just to get either the form or for those who had received the form the earlier to submit. And on that Monday, many young boys and young girls came. They were not inside the Michel Onano Stadium. They were, first of all, outside waiting for the people recruiting them to let them know when they could enter. And from survivors that I've managed to speak to, they told me that around 11 p.m., that's when they were told to go into the stadium. So there were so many, and that's where the stampede happened. And even when it was happening, many did not know that some people fell down and died, because some even were chanting that we made it, but later on some officials who were there told them that, look, in fact, some people are suffocating and some are even dying. And that's why when people start realizing that in that stampede and that crash, some young female and men died.
Is it normal to have a recruitment for the army or any sort of employment to be done within stadiums in Congo Brazzaville?
Well, the stadium was just one of the locations. We understand that the forms were being given at the museum, and the stadium was a second place where people could go and submit physically. Is it normal? That's not an easy question to answer, but at least the people were directed to the stadium during that process. And normally, the recruitment time was supposed to happen from 7:30 to 3 p.m. That's when things should start. But it was rather the population or the young people who wanted to enroll who decided to stay on up to late, waiting for Tuesday morning to be the first or the second, or at least to be the first to be received by the officials.
So has the recruitment been suspended?
Yes, the government has suspended the recruitment, but this is only in the capital, Brazzaville. The same recruitment is happening in the rest of the country. But the day of national mourning is countrywide. All flags in the country will be flying at half mast, and the drinking places and other dancing places won't be opening today in the memory of those who perished.
Yeah, and you know, I was just looking at the announcement by the military there. They're saying that we're recruiting about 1,500 people. You just told me that more than 5,000 people showed up at that stadium. Just how rampant is unemployment in Congo?
Well, the Republic of Congo is the third largest oil-producing country, so its economy is mainly driven by oil, but unfortunately the economy is not that diversified. So if people don't get the chance to work in the oil sector, so the public administration, the army and the police are the biggest employers in the country, and a chance for many youngsters who are really struggling to get formal employment apart from selling in the streets and doing all kind of jobs. So the police and the army are seen as a secure job, stable and a formal formal one that comes with a lot of benefits. It is believed that about 40%, that's the rate of unemployment in the country. It is even higher among those who complete universities. It's very, very difficult to get employment. And one of the survivors I spoke to, Mr. Michaud, he told me that he wanted to do that after knowing that the situation of getting an employment is really difficult. Now that with what happened, he's kind of discouraged and he's maybe trying to explore if there are greener pastures outside the Republic of Congo.
You know, details about this tragedy are still, you know, very scanty. Do you know why it's taken so long for the story to come out? How is it being covered over there?
Well, since yesterday morning, the government did release a nearly a death toll of 37 people initially. And on national television, there were already gospel songs being heard continuously. But what happened was also that during the early morning Tuesday, it's been raining cats and dogs in Congo Brazzaville. So the news did not spread through social media so much. So people were waking up to the news step by step. But also Congo Brazzaville is indeed a country with about 5 million people. So there are not so many media operating in the country. So that's why maybe it took some time for many people to realize what happened. Even among the victims who left the stadium, they did not understand how many people exactly perished during the tragedy.
And finally, Emery, how are people reacting to this tragedy?
Well, it really depends to who you talk to. The victims are extremely angry how things happened. One of them told me that the reason why they decided to stay on late and be the first to be received was that some people were paying to jump the queue and so on. So they wanted really to make sure that at least they could submit their forms of application. So it gives you an idea of how corruption also could play a role in the stampede and in the fact that people had to stay up till 11 p.m. or late at night waiting for them to be recruited. But the people from the civil society say that, well, the issue in the country is a lack of employment for the youth. They are the biggest chunk of the population of the country and opportunities are scanty. And whenever there is any chance of being recruited, so particularly in the capital, Brazzaville, the challenges and the opportunities being scanty, people can do everything possible for them to get a chance to find a formal job.
Thanks to Emery Makomeno. Thousands of girls across Africa are quitting school because of the rise in the cost of living. Many are swapping the classroom for low-paid work or early marriage. It's a story not unfamiliar to us. The international charity ComFed, the Campaign for Female Education, is calling on African governments and donors to redouble efforts to encourage girls to go back to school. Barbara Chilangwa is from the charity. Barbara was previously the permanent secretary at the Ministry of Education in Zambia, as well as a secondary school teacher herself. She spoke to my colleague Audrey Brown, who started by asking her, why are girls leaving school early and is it getting worse?
Yes, it is worse. It's getting worse, especially with the high cost of living. I think the global crisis has affected investment in education now, and the situation is getting worse. The schools are getting more and more under-resourced because the education ministries are lowering investment in education. And, you know, poor families have to make very hard choices once that happens. They have to think twice about how to use their scarce resources. And normally it's the girls that drop out. And that's why, yes, girls are still dropping out. And it's a major concern even across the continent, but in Zambia as well.
Are there countries where it's particularly acute?
It's mostly sub-Sahara Africa, also countries where there's conflict. For example, Ethiopia, Niger, there's also countries where there are cyclones like Mozambique and Malawi, other highly indebted countries, Ghana, Zambia included. Those countries that are facing these crises tend to reduce their cost to education and affect the resources going to the education sector, thereby making a situation that is already bad even worse.
Are governments aware of that, that by reducing education spend, it makes the situation worse and it in fact imperils girls particularly? And I'm just wondering, if they don't know, how come they don't know? And if they do know, why do they reduce education spend?
I think governments do know. It's just that they have to make difficult choices between where to spend their money. And it depends also on the policies that they have in place, the development plans that they have in place. But also, I think education somehow takes long to show the impact. And because it's a political thing, they feel that delaying giving more money for education may not show the political outcome.
So they prepare to risk the cost to these girls' lives for their political, shall we say, reputations, outcomes, or their hold on to power.
Which is unfortunate. In fact, I think because as civil society, we continue to dialogue with governments, sharing with them what ones programs that we think can support them in improving learning outcomes. To some extent, they listen. They listen in the sense that they invite us to sit on their policy-making bodies, their technical working groups, and they are interested in looking at our data that we show them as for what is working. So to some extent, they are listening, but they also have this choice to decide whether to put the more money in agriculture, for example, which feeds their countries, or to put more money in tourism that raises income for the country. So it's like being able to strike the right balance between giving more money to education or to something else. But it's a risk that we really can't afford to take.
What happens to the girls? What's the impact that it has on them when they drop out? And is there a kind of median age where it happens? Do families wait, or people wait until the girl is 14, 15, 16? Or is it slightly older or slightly younger?
The impact is dire, because what happens is that when they drop out of school, they sort of are endangering their lives now, because they go into early marriage, for example, or they go to lowly paid jobs, or they fall pregnant. It therefore requires that we focus on the age group that is really most affected, and which is the transition from primary school to secondary school. And also in rural areas where schools are under-resourced, there's also a big impact there.
Can you give us an example, perhaps, of what you've studied, people that you've met, young women that you've met that have had this happen to them? Give us an insight into the life of such a girl.
They tell us that if they didn't get the chance to be supported by comfort and remain in school, they probably would have had two children already, or they may have been married and divorced already. The good thing is that we don't just support them through school, we also help them transition into livelihoods when they succeed to complete secondary school.
When you go and talk to people in communities, they tell you that they would have been married with two children already. What age are they when they say that?
The secondary school sector that we focus on is age between 13 and 18. The examples I'm giving are mostly girls that we have supported through school. They may have dropped out of school. And our alumni, the young women that get together to give social support to other rural girls, we look for them. They find them and bring them back to school. And these are the ones that will tell us that, you see, I'm lucky I'm in school. If I wasn't in school, so many things would have happened to me, including getting married or having a child or children.
And then what happens to them when they go through your program? Is there resistance to having them not working, providing for the family, or not being married?
Not really. In fact, to say the advantage of going through a program is that there's a lot of peer-to-peer love skill that is shared between them and their other peers. They sort of get encouraged, having had the chance to attend school, but also being saved from the danger of having gotten into an abusive marriage, for example, or a lowly paid job, or working as maids in houses. This is the story that we usually are confronted with.
Now, I was wondering whether their family or their parents resist attempts to take them away from, you know, the path that had been set for them in life. So do they resist CAMFED's programs to get them into school or not to have them married off?
The CAMFED program is community-based. We speak with them, we demonstrate how taking their children to school will help even improving incomes at household level. And we also work with traditional leaders who also engage with their communities and encourage them to send children to school. So the fact that we are community-based and that we have an impact in the communities, we have young women going back to their communities to demonstrate that there's a difference between a girl that has gone through secondary school and one that has not been. But we face little resistance from the parents.
It strikes me from what you're saying that the places where this happens most is places where there's conflict, where there's poverty and things like that. It's also in those places of conflict where women suffer the most. They suffer the targeted attacks, rape in conflicts and things like that. It struck me that women are the canary in the coal mine. What should we say? The terrain, the arena on which all these issues play out in women's lives. They suffer the most whatever happens.
You are right. You are right because in many communities, yes, women are targets. The patriarchal upbringing that we have had and that we experience in our community still continues to take the upper hand.
So is there a girl that stands out in your mind that did really well, a story that gives you hope, gives us hope, gives those people listening right now hope that it's not all bleak and that the long-term consequences can be positive as well?
Oh, we have so many stories, but I think the one story that stands out is the current CEO of Comfort, who herself was supported by Comfort through school, who has spearheaded the creation of the alumni, that is the young women that Comfort has supported to create the Comfort Association, through which they give social support to other girls, and she's beaten the odds, and she's now heading the organization.
And what's her name?
Angie Murimirwa. I don't think she'll mind mentioning her name.
We just want to heap the praises and accolade her for overcoming it and for sticking with the program and making sure that other people, other girls like her benefit as well. Thank you very much, Ms. Chilangwa, for speaking to us about this.
Thank you very much and thank you for having me.
Thanks to Barbara Chilangwa from the charity Comfed. Thanks for listening to this episode. It was produced by Tom Kavanagh and Audrey Brown in London. Kani Sharp was in charge. Philip Bull was the technical producer. You can find this episode and others on BBC Sounds or wherever you get your podcast. Just search for Focus on Africa, hit the subscribe button and share widely. I'm Richard Gogoi. We'll talk again next time.
Every weekday morning, wake up to one big story from the African continent.
Where does Africa stand in this conflict?
How is Africa responding to the refugee crisis?
With me, Alan Kasuja, and Africa Daily.
So what's it like living in an area where Boko Haram are active?
One story from Africa, for Africa.
Our story.
Africa Daily.
That's Africa Daily from the BBC World Service. Find it wherever you get your BBC podcasts.